This is Dojo Live, Tech Without Borders, stories that bring us together. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dojo Live this Thursday, June 15th, 2023. My name is Kim Lantis, and it's my pleasure to be hosting along with America Guerrero today.
Hey, Kim. It's been a while.
It's been a while. I feel a little rusty, right? That's okay. Everyone needs to rest. And of course, today's guest of honor, the most important person of the Dojo Live episode, is Scott Weiner. Scott is CTO, or fractional CTO, Transformation Practice Lead at Nuion. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, this is going to be a very cool conversation as we talk about what proven techniques exist to transform team practice and performance. And of course, that word there that everyone strives for, right? High performance teams. What does that mean and how to get there? But before we do that, we'd like to know your story, Scott. What are you all about? What's your passion and what's kind of led up to Nuion?
Well, I'll try to give you the short version. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been building businesses for several decades. I started when I was first one when I was 16, I think, my first consulting and application development company. Along the way, I've learned that I'm really lazy. I like to do things once. So I like to do things once. I like to build something and I like to deliver it. And I like to see people get value out of it and see them buy it over and over and over again. That's fun for me.
So I think efficient, but I guess in some ways lazy and efficient can be synonymous.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just kidding. But I think really what I learned along the way was that I have a passion for two things. One is helping people and the other is building things that people really care about. I really love building products. I enjoy that process. But so I've been a CEO, a VP of engineering, a CTO along the way at multiple companies. And then about a decade ago, I connected with Nuion, which is a run by some people I had worked with at a former job in the past. So I kind of knew them. And they asked me to come on board. And it was funny because at first I was nervous about doing it because what Nuion does is they're strategic consultants. We do a lot of strategy work for companies, but typically on the technical space, we're called fractional CTOs, fractional CIOs. So we come in and do work. The way I try to look at it is, you know, the CTO work that I do is really around helping teams build software better. And the CIO work is really about helping companies use technology better. But we also do things in the security space. We have a CISO practice, we have a cloud practice, and so on. So, but everyone in our organization is kind of an ex-CXO. We all run companies before. It's a very senior kind of organization. So when I got involved with them, I was a little nervous because what I noticed was the founder that I met with, he's so smart in so many areas. He knows a little or a lot about everything. And he seems to know everyone. And it was just overwhelming. I'm like, I was really good at the stack I was working on. I knew a lot of depth I did, but the breadth was just overwhelming. And so I was really nervous. He said, don't worry, you'll be fine. So about a year later, this is about 9 years ago now, I was at some client site doing some work. And the client made a comment to me. He goes, how do you know so much about so many things? And so what I learned, and this was the beginning of what I want to talk about today, is that what my superpower is, and I'd say pretty much everyone at Nuion, is we pattern match really well. Mm. Work with so many organizations and we see so many different patterns of operation that we're just really, really fast at seeing what works, what doesn't, and been there, done that before. So just to give you an example, I personally have probably worked with a couple hundred companies now. A lot of them are startup companies, but some are, you know, very large organizations, a lot of mid-sized companies across dozens of industries. So I've seen a lot of patterns. And so I'd say about 9 years ago, I was focused on very technical stuff. I was doing a lot of architectural review, a lot of analysis of software. And what I was finding was all of the problems these companies were having, even though they were showing up as technical problems, were mm-hmm. people problems.
People. And that's going to be a constant, right? The tech stack might change. People, that's going to be there.
That's what happened. And that's exactly what happened is the people became the real focus of the work more than the technology. So I started trying to learn more about organizational behavior, team dynamics, things like that. I studied and read everything I could and then put it into practice in all these different opportunities we had. And I started noticing another pattern. And this is what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
I started noticing that I work with some really strong teams and some really strong team leaders. And no matter how strong those teams were, no matter how strong those team leaders were, like scrum masters, as an example, or product owners, or just managers, it didn't matter if the leadership of the organization and the culture of the organization didn't support what they were trying to do. It didn't matter. And I watched these great people bumping their heads up against these things and saying, why isn't it working? Well, it wasn't working because they were in an organization that wasn't supportive of what they were trying to do. So to be high performing takes more than just being a great team. And that was a real light bulb moment for me. The second light bulb came on, there's three. The second light bulb came on when I started to realize that the techniques that I have been learning and practicing, we'll talk about a few of them, really work. Like I can really take a team from wherever they are and move them forward. And what does high performance mean? Well, high performance means different things to different people.
But yes.
Generally, what I'm looking for is comparative. So if I go to an organization and say, point at your high performing team, and then I ask them, what makes them high performing? I don't mean how are they high performing, but what do you see that makes you feel they're high performing? Is it the output? Is it the quality? Is it the way they work together? What is it you like about them? Then that becomes the standard. And then the issue is, how do we get other teams to look like that or better?
And that's really interesting, because that kind of, I think, fits that question of figuring out what high performance means for you, I think, leans into the sort of boutique approach of Nuyen, right? Like you have these perhaps proven techniques that we'll talk about here in just a moment.
Yeah.
But there's not necessarily this one size fits all kind of approach, right? Mm-hmm. You definitely have to have proven techniques mixed in with the individuals as people, the company, and all of that.
The biggest mistake I see out there are people trying to install frameworks and strategies that are, like you just said, one size fits all, out of the box. They don't work because every organizations are living creatures. They have a personality to themselves. And if you start to try to structure things like, oh, it worked over here, so it'll work here. The worst case scenario, I forget the name of this, there's a name for this, but companies will bring in, let's say, a CEO from another company that was successful. And that CEO then will bring in the same strategies and techniques that worked over there into this new culture. And for some reason, it doesn't work.
It's like being a parent. I mean, my child number one and my child number two, I cannot treat them the same because they're not the same. Like, my first child made me think that I was like really great at this mom thing. And then my second child made me realize it was probably my child that was great and not so much me.
It makes me think that there are also other meanings for strong teams, right? Because you say that high performance, it could mean something to Kim or for me, but for what is the definition for a strong team? Is because they have, every individual has a strong personality because they know how to delegate, or what is that?
So let's start with, just to finish off with high performance for a second. High performance from a business perspective really means look at your peers out there in the industry and how are you doing compared to them? So there's a comparison piece to it. So if you were a manufacturer, for instance, you would look at other manufacturers and say, are we performing better than them based on the criteria? And this gets to your question, based on the criteria that we have set as important. And that we'll talk about that, because the criteria, the measurements, the metrics you use matter.
Yeah, exactly. For one manufacturer, that could just mean the bottom line. And for others, that could mean we're going to go green and we're going to do this with as little ecological impact.
Exactly. So, and that's a great point too. From the consultant's perspective, from the mindset of I'm coming in to help you based on your values, not my values. You know, I'm not there to impose my values on you. I'm there to support your values. So I have to understand your values and why they are what they are. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't move a little bit in the process, and we'll talk about that too. So what ends up happening in terms of a strong team is, I think it's exactly kind of what you're getting at. I mean, strength means that there's a sense of cohesiveness. That's really what strength means. And that strength can come from a variety of places. We're going to talk about a lot of them actually, but that strength of trust in each other, the ability to communicate effectively, the ability to flow, to get work to just flow through the process, the ability to adapt to different situations. That's a huge strength a strong team can do. There's a lot of different kinds of strength. We'll talk more about
that. Yeah, let's start from the very top. It's my understanding that you actually, I don't know if we can fit this all in into 20 minutes. I highly doubt it, but we can do our best. We've got about, I think, 10 or so of these proven techniques that you sort of wanted to touch on today. So what's technique number one?
Well, these are categories of techniques. So I think that each one of them is probably an hour or 4 hours unto themselves. But they get deep into the science of this.
You're welcome to come back and deep dive into each and every one of those.
Happy to do it.
Part two, part three, part four.
This truly sharing this is my passion. So I'm really happy to do this. I really want more people to know some of these things. So for instance, just to give you a back. So what happened was, as I started to learn that these techniques work, I started to realize that I didn't know how they worked. So I understood they worked, but not necessarily the why.
The science.
Right. And so the last piece of this is I spent the last few years really studying the neuroscience behind it and understanding what's really, you know, going on in our brains and our bodies that makes these things work and not work. So as we talk about this, I may touch a little bit on some of the neuroscience. I don't want to get too deep, but I do think that it's important to understand that this isn't magic. It's always people. I've gone to organizations where we made these subtle changes in the way they behave. And they've come back to me and told me they thought it was magic. And I keep telling them it's not magic. It is science. So let's start out. So what was the first one I want to talk about? Clear goals. I walk into an organization. First thing I look at for any team, let's talk about teams, not organizations. Sorry, I'm thinking high performance organization. For a team, I look at, do they have clear vision and goals? Why? Because it turns out that if we're not all going the same way for the same purpose, we won't be high performing. If you really want high performance, we all have to be on the same mission. So if we're not going the same way, if we're not clear on that, and by the way, having the leaders say, this is the mission, isn't good enough. Mm. Everyone on that team needs to be able to tell it back to me in their own words, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking for that connection, that cohesion, we're all going the same way. That actually falls, builds up on the trust side too. Trust comes from a sense of we're all trying to get to the same place. Think of it as positive intent. Mm-hmm. We're all being well, we're all trying to do the right thing. But are we all trying to do the same thing?
That's how granular does this have to be? I mean, if you can say, we need to get leads, or we need to create 4 new features. I mean,
great,
is that
great
helpful?
Question. Great question. So the first part is, are we all going the same way? To your point, getting leads would be going the same way. But the second part that we're going to talk about next is motivation and engagement. Now, here's the trick. They have to not only be going the same way, they have to be purpose driven, and purpose has to be bigger than themselves. Nobody gets out of bed, commutes 5 hours a day to a job, because I know people who do this, for a job where their goal is to get 4 more leads. You know, I mean, maybe there's, I mean, salespeople I want to leave out of this conversation. I want to talk more about like engineering, manufacturing, human resources, marketing, those types of teams, because sales has a different, they have more extrinsic motivators. They're much more motivated by, well, like the money, for instance. But most, and that's fine, but that's a specific type of job and a specific type of role where most of the value is going to be seen from external reward.
Right.
But most people, especially people who use, have cognitive and creative jobs, are motivated much more by their ability to get intrinsic rewards. And purpose is the biggest one. Purpose drives you in a way that almost nothing else will. So if you know that we're going to do something bigger than ourselves, you're going to operate better. I'll give you one example. I was at a very large bank doing a bunch of work, and I had a young data scientist come into me, actually a machine learning expert, come into me and say he was quitting. And I was a consultant there. I wasn't his boss or anything, just someone he trusted. So we kind of walked into my office there, which was a closet, and we sat down in the closet, and I asked him, what's going on? And he said, well, I'm really bored. I basically move data from one database to another. That's all I do all day. And I said to him, here's the thing. I'm a small business owner. And what you're really doing is you're moving data from a database to another database. But what that data is it's analytics that allows this particular bank to analyze me as a business owner more effectively and efficiently so that you can give me a greater loan and a faster rate. And then I'm able to use that money to hire more people and give them better jobs, which gives their whole families better lives. And you're doing that for millions of businesses. So you're making the lives of millions of people better. As I'm talking and explaining this, I mean, I did it much slower and broken up. He sat up higher in his seat. He breathed differently. He got this beaming smile on his face. And he looked at me and he said, why don't they talk to me like this all the time? And I don't know. But as far as I know, when I left, he was still there. So he didn't quit. So that's purpose-driven. That's what purpose-driven looks like. And when you're purpose-driven, you're much more apt to be motivated. So I want to see people not just have a clear vision and goal, but the vision and the goal must be bigger than themselves. It must be greater than themselves. I'm working at a healthcare organization right now, and I work with an engineering team, and we're doing, you know, very detailed, granular data work all day. And what do I do all day? I remind them we're saving lives. Mm-hmm. Every day, I remind them we're saving lives.
And are there any dynamics that you can implement with your teams to remind their what are the objectives? What is the purpose? Or do you have talks every week? Or what do you do?
I suppose this leans into your number two, which is
motivation and engagement.
Yeah.
It's part of creating a culture. So it is a leadership role, a modeling technique, right? So to your point, like when I'm leading a team, I do make a point of it that every time we have a conversation, I find a way to inject that into the conversation. Not always saying it, because me saying it really is just words. I try to get them to come back to me and tell me to reflect on how is what you're doing helping people and have them think about it. Learning happens when you ask the question, not when you tell them the answer. Okay. So if you want people to learn something, you don't just talk at them. You need them to ask. You need them to answer the questions. So that's really what I do is I try to engage them. Can't do it every day, you know, but whenever I can, that's what I do. I try to make it part of the culture. So I want a culture of continuous learning, curiosity, and I want a culture of purpose. And as long as we're purpose-driven, we're in better shape. And this brings me to the third one. And this is really important when we talk about high performance. Are they a value-delivering team or a task-delivering team? Okay, so here's the thing. We all get pleasure from finishing a task. We literally get a dopamine hit, right? There's actually literally a dopamine hit every time you finish a task.
And it feels so good to just write that little check mark on your list.
That check mark is magical, right? And basically it's because we're all drug addicts. We all love that dopamine hit, right? That's what it is. So the problem is with that is that that dopamine hit has nothing to do with the quality of the task. Whether that task is took the trash out or solve world peace, it's the same check mark, right? So that's the problem. So here's what I do when I'm pre-COVID, when I was in the room with all the developers and I was walking around, I would go up to engineers, and I've done this for years. I'll walk up to engineers randomly and just ask them how their day's going. Just want to connect. And they'll say something like great, or it's not so good. But when they say great, for example, it doesn't really matter what they say. The next question I ask them is why? Why is it great? And because I want to know, because I want more of that, you know, or why is it bad? I want to help. And the answer 90% of the time is I finished my task or I didn't finish my task, right? So it went great, I finished my task. So my next question to them, because they're feeling very good at that moment, is was your task valuable? How do you know? And almost every time I ask that question, the answer is some stumbling and bumbling around, which is basically a way of saying, I don't know. They're in, I'm going to finish a task mode, not I'm going to deliver value mode. And so what we spend a lot of energy on with high performing teams is making sure that they know there's a big difference between finishing a task and delivering value. Now, to deliver value, you have to ask a lot of questions. You have to ask why a lot, because just because someone hands you a piece of work to do doesn't mean it's valuable. You know, why waste your time doing anything that's not valuable as an organization, as well as a team or an individual? So part of it. Does that make sense?
It does. I do think, at least in my mind, it doesn't mean that it's mutually exclusive, right? It doesn't mean I think that task delivery is a bad thing. No. But to understand, going back to the why, like even if this is just a small piece of the puzzle and this value here isn't necessarily the
right
end all, it's right. The next piece to get there.
Right. And exactly. It's connected to a bigger purpose. So for instance, there's an old story, and I'm gonna mess it up, but I'll tell you the gist of it, because I love the mythology behind it. So in the 1950s, the myth kind of goes, that one version of it is John F. Kennedy was taking a tour of NASA before the moon launch, and he bumps into a gentleman there and says, that clearly worked there, and said, oh, what do you do? And he says, I'm helping put a man on the moon. And he was very proud, and he was the janitor. But he understood about what he did and how it connected to the larger mission. He knew the value of it. And the question I always ask when I do some classes and stuff, the longer version of this, is can you imagine how spotless those floors were, right? Think about it. How you just know intuitively that he was more motivated to do a good job because he understood the purpose.
Yeah, of it. I get to be part of this. Yes, yeah. I love that.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So that's all well and good. So we have a team now that's motivated. They're purpose driven. They're doing their thing, and that's great. And then we get to the next one, which I find is either enabling or debilitating for a team, which is the way metrics and measurement play in their world. So what happens is, I'm going to say this in a very harsh way, when external metrics are imposed on a team, you must report on X. You know, we want to know how you're doing on something. We want to report on you as a team externally to management, whoever. The reason they do that, there's a couple of reasons, but the main reason they do that is a trust deficit. If you trusted them, if you felt they were doing what they needed to be doing, you wouldn't be asking. So it's not that, like I've heard managers say like, well, I want to compare my team so that I can fix problems. That's a trust issue, right? There's a sense that I can do better than my team. But if you as an individual can do better than these 10 people in this team or 7 people, whatever it is, then one of you shouldn't be there. Like you, the team has all the capabilities they need if they're high performing. They have everything they need to be successful or not. And so when you have external measurements, two things happen. One, there's a trust issue. Two, you're taking agency away from the team. You're essentially saying you are now responsible for determining what matters. And the minute you do that, there's a saying, I forget who said this, but whenever you measure something, you end up valuing it. So what happens is we tend to value the thing we're being asked to measure. It culturally, we have a cultural shift. If you tell me, for instance, velocity really matters, and we're going to track velocity across all our teams and measure it and compare it, then all of a sudden, what does the team care about? Velocity. Velocity has nothing to do with delivering value.
And in terms of trust, do you trust the individuals since the beginning, or is that something that you gain with time?
Well, if it's a high-performing team, the trust is there. It's really hard to have a high-performing team where there isn't a sense of trust. If it's a low-performing team or a team that's maturing or a new team, trust is something you build, right? You start with positive intent, meaning inherently you have trust when you first start, but then things happen. Oh, they didn't meet their deadline, so now there's a little trust issue. Maybe we'll measure them to figure out what went wrong and fix it, right? So things start to happen. Now, I'm only talking about external metrics so far. I haven't talked about internal metrics in the team. That's a different story. We'll talk about that separately. So external metrics need to be very carefully chosen because they affect culture. And what happens is, there's another saying, which again, I'm terrible at remembering who said this, I apologize, but the thing we measure is the thing we will gain. We will gain whatever we measure. And here's the part they don't say in the saying, that we don't believe in. So for instance, if I tell you every time you push this button, you're gonna get a dollar, you'll push the button. In fact, you'll try to come up with some creative way to have that button get auto pushed.
Yeah. Right? 24/7, 365. Yeah.
If you don't believe in the reason I want you to push the button on a regular basis, then mm-hmm. it won't matter. I'll give you an example of this is we had a product where there was a screen where if you did this action unintentionally, you could cause a lot of damage. So every time you push the button to start this process, a little alert would pop up that would say, are you sure you want to do this? Do you understand what you're about to do? And you have to hit okay and then go on. Well, the first dozen times someone got that alert, it was useful. But you know what started to happen? People just would go push, 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 push. They wouldn't even look at it anymore.
I know.
Right. Mm-hmm. They didn't believe it. They didn't think it was valuable to have that there anymore. And sure enough, it caused problems. So having metrics that you believe in creates better outcomes.
Can you give us some examples of those?
Yep. We're going to do that. So that's the that'll get into the internal one. So I just want to wrap up for the external because those are critical. It's not that you don't need some external metrics. It's that when you do that, there needs to be a conversation and an acceptance with the team that they believe in the value of it.
If like the why. Why are we measuring this? Exactly. Like, is our stick rate increasing? Is, you know, our churn decreasing? Or
So, like, well, that's the other thing. Is we're picking the right. This is the other problem with metrics. And this comes from the book Tyranny of Metrics, which I highly recommend. It's a great book on the subject. They talk about the idea that metrics are metrics often will be will often measure the thing that is easiest to measure. And the thing that is easiest to measure is often, if not most of the time, not the right thing to measure. In other words, the thing that we want to measure is usually very complicated to measure. And so we use some simple placeholder for it. Here's the problem. Once we measure the thing that's the wrong thing to measure, we change our cultural norms based on that measurement. So we get these bad behaviors because we're measuring the wrong thing. I had a team once where the manager said, I need people to go faster. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, I'm going to give them a $1,000 bonus that they can increase their velocity by 10% or whatever. And I said, you know what you just did? He said, what? I said, you just created a lot of 20-point stories.
And your quality went,
And quality goes down because that doesn't matter to that number, right? So getting the right measurements and the right things to measure, and the reason I'm not giving you a clear answer on this is it does depend on the situation.
Right. Well, we talked about the very beginning,
exactly.
The boutique approach.
Right. So now let's talk about the internal and answer some of the questions you were asking. So internal measurements, it's sort of the same thing, except that when you're measuring internally, you also need to think about what are we really trying to do? What do we really care about? And so I usually recommend having a team charter or some type of value statement internally to the team so they're clear on what their operating procedures are and what they care about and what they believe value looks like. And so then they measure the things that will help them measure that. And by the way, not always easy, right? Measuring the right thing is hard. So what do they tend to do? They estimate. They do velocity checks. They do all these things that are easy to do, but actually create bad behaviors. So understanding that is a big deal. So let's talk about estimation for a second as part of this. Estimation is a funny one. I did a study a couple of years back. We took about 80 to 100 teams across the world. This was a worldwide study we did with one company. It's a global company. And what we did is we said, we're gonna for 5 months or 6 months, 5 or 6 months, we're going to look at all of your sprints and we're gonna say, how much time did you spend estimating? Okay. And we said, now what we're going to do is look at your predictive ability. So we looked at how many story points they estimated per sprint, just added them up, and then we averaged them. And then we did the same thing. Well, no, of course I wouldn't do that, but we did. And then we did the same thing, but instead we just counted how many stories did they predict they were going to finish. In every single case across all of these companies, there was one exception that was an anomaly for a reason. But for every case, basically what happened was the prediction around how many stories they were going to do was far more accurate than the points. So for instance, if they said on average, we're gonna do 20 points per sprint, maybe they did 12, maybe they did 25, where we said, we're gonna do 7 stories per sprint, regardless of size, didn't matter what the size was, they were more accurate. And there's actually a really good reason for this. And the law of averages basically says, if I know for the last 6 months, how many stories I was delivering every 2 weeks, then regardless of size, on average, I have a pretty good sense if the nature of the work doesn't change drastically. Obviously, if the nature of the work, the technology, the stack, the people on my team, that's going to be a reset. But that's going to happen no matter what estimation strategy you use. So there's a difference between making stuff up around points and actually counting stories. So counting takes me 5 seconds, okay? I can literally just count my backlog and divide by number of sprints, and I have a number, right? So if there's 100 stories and I do 10 per sprint, 10 sprints, done. With story points, the problem is that there's a lot of conversation that goes on with the story print, the story process, right? And so what ends up happening is if you have a disagreement about a story, there's two things going on. One, you're doing something really valuable. You're getting a shared understanding. You know, I think it's a 2. I think it's an 8. Why? That conversation is immensely valuable. What's not valuable is saying, I think it's a 2. I think it's a 3. And have in debating that. So what? These are relative values. They're not actual numbers or dates or whatever. So it's like you're wasting time. So anyway, we added up how much time they were spending on estimation in a year, and then we took their salaries into account, and it was roughly $800,000 was spent on estimation, where I can do the whole thing in a couple of seconds, okay? So I'm not saying that $800,000 was completely wasted, but a lot of it was. And so we did that math too, and it turned out, I think it was like about 300,000 of it was literally arguing about numbers, not actually getting anywhere on understanding. We actually monitored all this. So it comes out that, and by the way, I'm not the only one that's run this experiment. There's lots of literature on this. So what it comes out to is, it's not that estimation using traditional techniques is bad, but know why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the value of it? And the value of it is not your ability to predict more accurately.
Right. And when to stop. Yeah, a 2 or 3, we're fine. We don't need to argue much there. But when it's a 2 and an 8, it's like there's value there. And I think what happens is, even when there's that healthy conflict, whoever happens to lose, all right, we're going to decide it's an 8, the 2 can get on board with that because he or she was heard, or vice versa, I think leads into the next topic here, but we're actually at the end of our half hours.
Yeah. I knew that was going to happen. There's a lot more to this. So I think just to summarize, there's a lot more we can talk about in terms of the high performance, but I think that the other areas real quick that we would want to talk about are really about making sure the team feels accountable for the work. That comes out of some of the things we talked about. Having really good communication skills. We brushed on that topic of psychological safety. It's a huge topic. It's really important. If you don't feel you can make mistakes and share, then you will not be high performing, period. So that has to be dealt with. Balancing the team, making sure you have a team that can get the job done. We talked about trust, resource management, automation. If you're talking engineering specifically, automation is a huge part of it. You're not going to be high performing without automation. So I see these new teams that say, why aren't we high performing? It's like, well, you're not there yet. You got to build up. Mm-hmm. And finally, the big one that we left out, which is a whole topic.
I'm going to give us, if you've got the time, we've got the time for our listeners. There's no hard stop here, because I think this is one that's really important. We were talking pre-show a bit on this. So continue and take your time.
Which one do you want to talk about?
I think what you wanted to talk about was the leadership component, right?
Sure. So, okay. So I'm going to tell you a quick story then, because I think this will help understand that there's two parts to leadership. There's being purpose-driven. There's different kinds of leaders, right? There's transactional leaders and there's transformational leaders and there's other types of leaders. Transactional leaders are ones who say, if you do this, I will give you this. Or if you make this mistake, I will give you this punishment. You know, very, very transactional. That kind of leadership can work in areas where you're basically having people do really repetitive type work. It's great at McDonald's. You know, it's great to kind of say you're going to get paid for coming in and doing your job, you know. But if you're talking to people who are doing a lot of creative work, technical work, things like that, it's not very motivational. And it doesn't help them become very adaptive people who learn and grow. So what you want is more transformational. Transformational leadership looks like this. First of all, it's purpose-driven. We're doing it for a reason, the why, right? Second of all, it is directed. I mean, leadership is directional. It's the general who says, take that hill, but also says, here's why we need to take it, you know, and why you should care about taking that hill. So that's part of it, is being a transformational leader. It really helps with performance. The second part of leadership, though, is to understand that you are not more important than the team. You are there to support the team. And if you
can't, and I'm going to take the hill with you.
If you can't get it through your head that the people who are, I hate using that analogy, but taking the hill matter more than you in the act of taking the hill, not maybe in other strategic ways, but taking the hill, then you're not really leading. You may be micromanaging, you know, you may be, you know, and Stephen Covey was one of my favorite of all time in this area of motivational speaking. He would talk about the idea of if you tell someone how to do their job, then you become responsible for their work. And this falls into the idea of autonomy. So autonomy is a very important part of creating a high-performing team. So if a team feels disenfranchised, like my leader's telling me what to do, how to do it, when to do it, you know, then I'm going to do what they told me to do because they said so, because that's gaming the system. You know, if it goes wrong, their fault. You know, they didn't tell me. You know, so you want people to feel accountable. You got to be the kind of leader that really supports but doesn't drive the work, doesn't tell people how to do the work, but gives them inspiration to want to do the work, lead them. And so that's a big part of this. They also be very good decision makers. There's a great book called Thinking Fast and Slow that talks a lot about the decision process, the cognitive bias that comes in. Things like prospect theory, which basically says that we're more apt to be worried about losing something than gaining something. So that plays into our mindset a lot. You know, good teachers. If you ever had your kids ever have a good teacher, they won't say you're going to lose. You're going to get this grade if you do well. They're going to say you're going to lose the A if you don't do well, right? Because kids are more afraid of losing than gaining. We tend to overestimate our intuition. You know, we have this knack of thinking that we can make it up based on our experience alone, when really we need to do analysis and look at the situation. There's a whole bunch of others we won't get into right now, but there's a whole bunch of decision processes Thinking Fast and Slow talk about that I think is really great for this piece of it. They got to be good decision makers. Inspirational, purpose-driven, clear goals and vision. All of this comes into the leadership. It isn't easy. Not everyone should do it. But there's another piece to it. Good leaders create better leaders. In other words, their whole job is to create leaders out of everyone that works for them. Think about using the military example again. What does a great general do? Creates more generals, mm-hmm. right? Their whole job really is to get people to get better at what they do. Now, I am not implying that good engineers should become managers. Leadership and management are not the same thing, right? A leader is someone who is inspiring. In fact, this is the other thing we didn't talk about before, but when I look at really high-performing teams, one of the things I notice is there is no leader. There is a leader in the moment. So depending on what they're doing, someone takes leadership and everyone else trusts them and follows. But in any given moment, someone else might be the leader. That's a high-performing organization.
That leans into the adaptability that we also touched on, and even just the human nature. Like, yeah. I'm more knowledgeable about this. I thrive off of this. I'm more passionate about it. Or quite simply, guys, I'm in a tough space right now, and I can't. Like, I, you know, help.
And I think we talked about all the top level. I will say under each one of these, there's a lot more in terms of, you know, people will react to some of the things I said and say, well, what about, you know, this situation? Or I had a different experience. I'm sure they did. And the thing is, within each of these categories, there's different scenarios and context that needs to be added to this. So this is a lot of conversation. I love having these conversations. Would love to have more of them with you or anyone. This is something I really enjoy. I hope you can see.
Yes, and we completely enjoy it as well. I mean, we'd love to have you back on Dojo Live for part two, where we can dive a bit deeper into that second half of what we were only able to dabble on today. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our time together. It has been amazing, Scott, learning from you, talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
You're welcome. Take care just a second as we go off air. But before we do, we want to remind our audience that you can catch our recap show on Monday morning. And then we've also got a couple shows coming up this next week as well. That's going to be just one for right now. And that's with Travel X and Sushil Chowdhury. So don't miss it. We'll see you next week, 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific. Bye for now. Check out past episodes, transcripts, blogs, and more on our website, dojo.nearsoft.com.